This is Seattle, Washington, February 13, 8 p.m. I intend to tape a discussion with Erling Sandnes concerning the activities of the Teamsters 1937, 38, 39, and 40 in South Dakota, North Dakota, and Iowa. This is Seattle, Washington, January 30th, 1988. I intend to tape a discussion with Erling Sandnes of Bismarck, North Dakota, concerning the drivers' movement in North Dakota, South Dakota, 1938, 39, and 40.
Hello.
Jack.
Yes.
Erling Sandnes. Did you get my letter, Jack?
I did. It was kind of abrupt.
Huh?
It was kind of short.
Oh.
I didn't get it till Thursday.
Oh, that's too bad.
And I do have things planned, you know, Erling.
Yeah, I know.
And I don't like to have my schedules arbitrarily set for me.
Yeah. So if we could, you know, set some time, Jack.
Well, we may as well set this time because we may as well use this time.
Is that okay with you?
Yeah, but now in your letter there, you say you want to go over all of this. That's a pretty big order.
Oh, yeah, I know it is.
Well, go ahead, let's see where we're at, and
if we could, that bakery driver strike seems to be the first big one in Sioux City that I've kind of come across, I thought maybe we could start with that, Jack.
Well, now, how far are we going to go on? You know, some time ago I told you that I didn't care. You told me that there was a group in Omaha contacted you and wanted to talk about Sioux City.
Uh-huh.
And I told you that, now why don't they start in Omaha?
Start in Omaha?
Well, that's, if there was a group there, well, that's where the center of it was, really.
Yeah.
But you go ahead and I'll go along. And
I think somebody else is working on Omaha, Jack. I don't know who it is.
Well,
I haven't had any contact with them.
Yeah, well, I tell you something now, you know. I have a little sore spot in my heart for the SWP.
Uh-huh.
I went through a lot of goddamn years with Farrell Dobbs,
uh-huh.
And I was very loyal to him.
Yeah.
And when Farrell died, and the memorial service, the local branch here charged people to come to it, which I think was a sacrilege.
Uh-huh.
And secondly, they had originally contacted me and asked me if I would participate, and I said I would. Later on, they told me that I was not a friend of the party, and they did not allow me to say one word in behalf of Farrell. He was a dear friend of mine,
yeah.
And a loyal fellow worker.
I think in his books, you know, mentions you so many times.
And the fact is that they had a young girl there. It was a sacrilege what they pulled off here.
Huh.
And I'm not very partial to writing anything on behalf of the Socialist Workers' Party because they have distorted Trotsky and they're running away from him.
Yeah.
And although I never was a disciplined member of the Socialist Workers' Party, I did follow what I felt the teachings of Cannon and Skoglund and Ray Dunn and later Dobbs and Mickey Dunn, and I don't want to get involved in rewriting Farrell's books, really. I'll tell you that very clearly.
Oh yeah,
understanding, Farrell and I, when we were writing the books. We started them in 1955, and now we didn't get around to getting down to them until Farrell had time when he retired from the party.
Yeah.
And we went to bat on it. And I can't prevent anyone from saying what they want to do or anything, but I can't rewrite Farrell's books, and I'm not going to be a party of it.
I don't think that I haven't run into anything that's been in conflict.
There's lots of things in that history there that are written. I don't mind amplifying from time to time on them, but I'm not going to go through a 22-week, that's a long strike, and you don't know what that entails.
Yeah.
If I took the rest of the summer, I couldn't explain it all. And I don't know what you have in mind there. I just want you to understand where I'm coming from.
Oh, yeah. All I'm interested in is kind of the highlights, Jack.
I can help you out on a specific question. I don't care to be quoted or anything on it, because I'm not going to get involved in being a traitor as far as the books or Farrell is concerned. Everybody has their own style, and we agreed. And I was the one that was out in that country. Occasionally, Harry DeBoer and Ray Rainbolt would bounce in. But I spent 3.5 years out there. They aren't in the area. But go ahead and ask your question. I just want to let you know where I'm coming from.
And if I, like I said, I've been kind of wondering about this myself, you know, if I would come up with anything that seemed to be in conflict with Farrell.
Well,
I haven't run into that yet, but I'm...
I didn't care to get into the Sioux City situation, but I'll go on this evening with you.
Okay.
So you will fire away whatever you've got.
Well, do you remember the names of the bakeries, Jack, that were involved in that?
Well, I gave them to you the other day, and I'll go through them again. There was Metz, was the big hometown bakery.
Continental.
Uh-huh. There was Iowa Baking Company. And there were several bench shops that I can't recall.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And their name slips my mind, and if they would be recalled, even, you know, the ones that employed drivers, the big drivers, was Continental and Metz and Jacob Schindler. He run the Iowa Baking Company. Now, there were some other efforts made there, and there was a bunch of legal action on it when I think the Ward or the General Baking Company and one other attempted to use Sioux City as a means to dump their stale goods, shipped it in from Omaha. And we had severe problems with that. But they did not have a fleet of trucks on the street their own. What they done, they run an ad in the paper, and they solicited people who had cars or van trucks or panel trucks, as they called them then, that were consignment. You'd come in the morning and you'd buy this day-old bread, thrift store stuff from Omaha, and they had a store there as a retail outlet, and these drivers would then go house to house in the neighborhoods selling this day-old bread, and that, of course, bothered the drivers because it cut into their sales. And it affected amounted to a wage cut with them. Because when you have a door-to-door company coming in and selling bread and bakery goods, well, the people don't go to the store, and the drivers build these routes up. And when they build them up to a point, then the company would split them. And they'd cash in on them, so the drivers were working hard. And then these thrift stores come in with door-to-door stuff. And we just had to put our foot down on it. And there were some several rhubarbs about it.
Was this an issue during the strike, Jack?
No, nothing worked during the strike. There wasn't a thing on the street that was working during the strike. Jets and Continental, and people were getting bread. They were going to South Sioux City, and there was bread being, and we didn't object to it. If people could get bread through the local supermarkets or the equivalent at that time. And a lot of the merchants in their stores went to Omaha or other cities that were neighborly there where they had small town bakeries. There are several towns within there. There are 2,000, 5,000 people. And they'd go there and get a load of bread and then sell it in their store. We didn't bother them. They weren't breaking our strike.
And that strike lasted for some time.
About a month.
Yeah. I haven't found a whole lot about it in the paper.
Well, there wasn't a lot about it. The bakers and the drivers got together, the inside bakers, and we shut them down. And they didn't attempt to run any trucks in the city of Sioux City.
Uh-huh.
And the Metz company operated another baking plant in Sioux Falls, and they ran across east from Sioux Falls into southwestern Minnesota, and they served their feeder routes out of there. And that was the occasion of the frame-up that we went to prison over. And that was a sad damn thing there, and it ruined my life and ruined everybody else's life, and it was a horrible thing for the government under Roosevelt to start framing the working class, which he did to us.
Yeah, Farrell covered that well in his book.
Yeah, well, that's it.
And
it was an absolute frame-up. And it was no different than Meese and his bunch of bastards today and the CIA and the FBI hounding the people that are against contrade.
Now, there was something that I did see in one of the papers, Jack, that had to do with Metz Bakery being charged with the ICC under something that they termed discrimination.
They what?
It had to do with Metz Bakery that was apparently not complying with either ICC rules or else Iowa or Minnesota state law that had to do with the number of ounces that each pound of bread had to contain.
Well, I wouldn't put that...
Huh? Do
we
call anything about
Well, that? I don't know about ICC on the amount of... I do recall vaguely, this was a common thing with many bakers.
Uh-huh.
They were selling 16-ounce loaves of bread, and there was actually less than 16 ounces. And they tried to get rid of it all different ways, that it had baked out, that it was moisture and everything else.
That's what this issue is concerned. If somebody filed a complaint with the ICC and the ICC ruled against that.
Well, now the Interstate Commerce Commission is what I understand the ICC to be. Are we talking about the same thing?
Yeah.
Well, then what they were doing, they were fraudulently transporting goods in interstate commerce. I suppose that would be the theme of it. I don't recall when that happened. It certainly didn't happen during the strike.
It was during this period of time, Jack. I don't have the date right before me here now.
In 1938, in May and June?
Mm-hmm. And,
well, now the inside bakers would have been the ones that knew about that.
Okay.
I don't recall that.
Okay.
We had other things going on, I did at least, and we were organizing the motor freight drivers. And I wasn't in Sioux City every day, every hour.
Yeah.
I'd be gone into Chicago, into Omaha, into Des Moines, and places like that. Now, a thing like that could have happened.
Okay.
And I was not aware of it. But whatever it was, it would have been a harassment move by the union to, and that would have had to come from the inside bakers.
Okay.
Because who would have the knowledge that they were? They used to have a weight, as I remember, when they were setting those things up in the bakery.
Uh-huh.
And it constituted what the net weight of that bread should be, and there was allowances made for the moisture that would be cooked out of it.
Uh-huh.
And they probably Mets would cheat on his mother. So it isn't unusual that he, and you, if you cheat an ounce or a half an ounce out of the tremendous amount of wolves you get, you got a little, he can afford to go around the world like he did in more than Borsellini hats for $40 a shot.
Yeah. So, did you recall, Jack, what the issues were in the bakery drivers?
Of course.
Was it closed shop?
What?
Was closed shop an issue?
Well, I thought we got over that before, but I'll go through it again. The closed shop really was not a life and death matter for us.
Right.
We put that in the original bargain. And we said that the union should be the sole representative of all persons working in the plant or on the terminal, and that we would represent them all, and that everyone would belong to the union, and there was a trial period. But there wasn't made, like many unions, demanded the closed shop per se. We were interested, number one, in the conditions of the men, the security of their job, their right to seniority, to move up and down to the jobs that were senior jobs and better jobs. But what we were after there was the recognition of the union and a signed contract with a stipulated amount of weekly maximum hours that could be worked, a minimum right of pay, certain conditions, and for the drivers, percentage, they had a practice, and still do, I believe, that the drivers were given a base amount of money. Let's say, for sake of argument, $32.50 a week.
Yeah.
And that would be based upon gross sales of $325. Now, when they went over $325, there was an additional amount of commission paid to them, like they'd get an extra percent if they went to 350 and to 400. And then when they hustled and built the route up, and when it got to a certain amount of money, the companies then used to split the routes. So we had provisions built in for splits, and how many weeks they'd get it after they built the route up, that they'd get the route earnings for. They're kind of complicated, but basically we wanted recognition of the union. We wanted to be the sole bargaining unit, and we wanted seniority rights. We wanted things for their uniforms, who was to take care of the uniforms, who was to clean the trucks out. Trucks, if they're not cleaned out in bakery, they have to be cleaned. And that's a job. And if they keep them dirty, a disease develops called rope. And it gets into the bread at a later date. They called it, as I recall, rope, R-O-P-E. And it causes the bread not to be closely kneaded, but to have big air holes in it. They call it rope. And the bakery and the trucks and everything had to be clean. The bakeries were where the rope come in, but the trucks, they wanted the drivers to clean the trucks out on their own time. They didn't have them wash them. They had a washer for that. But those were working conditions. And we wanted a standard work week and hours that all the bakeries started together, a uniform starting time for all bakeries, so that they, if 6 o'clock was the agreed upon hour, the drivers would be on the street not before 6. Or 7 or 8. And there was an agreement, barring bad roads, they were to be in the barn by a certain time in the afternoon or late in the day. That allowed that one driver couldn't come in and poach and hustle the other guy's routes. Those were standard things in bakery contracts that we wanted for the drivers.
Was the strike successful, guys?
Of course. We won the strike, hands down, and the men went back to work, and we won the... It was a victorious settlement for the union.
Was there any back pay, do you recall?
There was no back pay because the men, when they went back to work, started getting paid.
Okay.
The amount, there was no retroactivity.
Okay.
If they agreed on X dollars when they went back, back to work. That was the commitment. They got X dollars a week starting the week one.
But these bakeries, these major bakeries all signed it.
They all signed it, yeah.
Victorious.
Mm-hmm. It was a victory for the union.
Jack, you remember a man by the name of Leo Barrett?
Who?
Leo Barrett?
Yes, Leo Barrett was a wonderful fellow. He was the business agent of the Young Irishman. And he was a very competent baker. And he was the business agent and president for the inside bakery workers.
Okay. And those people were not in 383, right?
No. They were in the Bakery Workers International Union. Bakery, I can't remember, yeah, they changed it.
It was
bakery and confectionery.
Yeah.
But they were in the regular bakery union.
Okay, I've got that in my notes.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, was he a young man in those years?
He was older than me, but he wasn't young. I mean, he wasn't old. He was older than me, but he was a young man. I think Leo was about 29.
About 29.
Yeah, 29 or 30. He was a couple of years older than I.
Okay.
And I was about 26, I guess, at the time, 25.
Do you remember who he worked for, Jack? Do you recall what bakery he was with?
Well, I would guess he was with, I don't know. I wouldn't want to quote that, but it would seem to me that he was with Metz or Continental. He didn't work for Jake. He didn't work for Iowa Baking Company.
His name comes up often in that.
He was a dynamic fellow.
Uh-huh.
And he had a lot on the ball, too.
Yeah,
he was a courageous guy.
Uh-huh.
He'd fight at the drop of the hat. I mean, if he got in an argument with him,
uh-huh,
and you got nasty, you're going to New City if you persisted. He didn't back up from nobody.
Uh-huh.
And he wasn't a violent person. But those days, when non-union people started baiting you, that you were shaking them down. Here's a fellow that worked in the bakery. He was a baker. And he was a competent baker, not just a machine baker. He learned the trade. He was a bench baker in addition. There's a difference. The specialist bakers that work in these big bakeries, they work with big equipment. Then the bakers that work on the bench, where they make pastry and cakes and things like that, they call them bench bakers. He was an all-around baker. He'd been in the trade for a long time.
How about a man by the name of Lawrence Schneiders?
Lawrence Schneider?
Schneiders. S-C-H-N-E-I-D-E-R-S.
Yeah, I think we called him Lawrence Schneider. Now, it seems to me that he was a driver for Continental.
I think you're probably right. And Wonder Bread.
That's right. That's Continental.
Is that Continental?
Yeah, that's Continental. That was their trade name. That's Continental Bacon.
Yeah, you're right. And he was the, apparently 383 had a bakery driver's
section. We had a bakery driver section.
Yeah, section. And he was the, did they call it a president of that section? Or?
No. He would have been a,
whatever.
He would have been a shop steward.
Shop steward.
But I think the guy who was really more powerful than he was Jimmy Murphy.
Jimmy Murphy.
Yeah.
His name comes up also.
Yeah, he was another very persuasive guy, and he was a guy about 33 years old. They were all young men.
I haven't been able to find any of those bakery drivers to talk to, and I was wondering.
Well, I don't imagine there's any around.
I found quite a few coal drivers, and, you know, in the...
You mean in person? Have you been in Sioux City?
Yeah.
Oh.
And a number of old Beacon drivers and Watson drivers.
Well, they are an area now of guys that weren't there during the strike.
And but I haven't run into any bakery. Drivers.
Well, you see, the big supermarkets kind of displaced a lot of the bakeries. When they started putting in their own bake shops, Safeway and whatever your trade stores are, they are they market their own bread. And there was fights in the Teamsters Union over the platform deliveries. It used to be at one time, the bakery drivers would deliver a load of bread to the platform at, say, Safeway or Kroger's or whatever, Red Owl or whatever the store was. And the driver would be paid a commission for all those crates of bread. If there was 100 loaves in there and whatever the bill was, he got a commission on it. Well, then the big bakers, the chains, the big chains that developed their own bakeries, developed their own green rooms for produce, they objected to paying the commission to the salesman driver, and they displaced him by using their own product, and they gave him a place on the shelf. And there was no more platform delivery like there was at one time, and they had a place on the shelf, and they'd come in with their truck, and they'd bring in a little two-wheel truck, and truck in three or four trays, and they were allotted space on the shelf. And the companies were pushing their own bread. So that cut down the number of people that were working in them shops, because the big chains had their own bakeries, in-house bakeries a lot of places. And if they didn't, they had a big bakery, a central bakery, and they began delivering it. So that whole scene changed, early as 1950. It was just about, there's hardly any of the old thing. It's all big. Done by the big shops. If they haven't got their own shops, they deliver it from their central bakery, and they allow Wonder Bread to put in 12 loaves or this, 10 loaves of that, but they push the house bread because they make more money. That's why it's hard to find bakery drivers, maybe, now.
Jack, do you remember about how many bakery drivers were in local 383? Just a talk, give me some idea.
It was over 100, I would say. Jake had about 30, Jake Schindler, and Metz was much bigger than that, and Continental was about the same. They had to have 50, 60. They had some transport drivers, and they had route drivers. They had some commercial drivers, and they had some, they didn't have any house-to-house delivery, none of those, except Jake. Jacob Schindler had it, and he done with the ethnic trade in the Jewish districts.
Yeah. Now, when you settled with Metz, did that affect what the 749 and Sioux Falls? Were they out?
No, they weren't organized there. No. And we didn't settle with Metz. We settled with all the bakers. There was no one company unit. They signed as a unit. There was no, they accepted the same agreement.
Did they have their own association, Jack?
Well, Metz was running a show there, and they were all together on it. They were united.
Okay.
I don't know what their, I wasn't privy to their inside deals, but Metz and Continental and Jake, they were bargaining through an attorney, a Byron Sifford or a Warren Sifford, I think was his name.
S-I-F-F-O-R-D or something.
That's
like
it.
And then after about a month then they...
We caved them in. They were resisting any kind of a settlement. And we finally charged them with unfair labor practices and everything, and along that practice they settled it. And I'd say it was about a month, 30, 35 days.
Was the NLRB involved, you remember, Jack?
Yes.
Okay. You filed your unfair labor
practices. We charged the bakers with unfair labor practices.
Okay. And I suppose the NLRB came out and...
Well, they sent a guy in, and he held for the union, I'm sure, because if he didn't, there wouldn't have been any settlement.
Right.
They did not attempt to operate, but they were operating, you see. They had a big, big plant down in Omaha, Continental Baking Company, and the lawyer that was really advising them how to handle it up there was... the guy that Roosevelt later appointed to be the ambassador to Ireland. And he was chief counsel for the Union Pacific Railroad. I'm trying to think of his name. And he was an Irish fellow. And Roosevelt appointed him to an ambassador to Ireland later on. And he had a daughter, a younger daughter, when they were filming Boys Town. Trying to think of his name off the top of my mind, it don't come to me right now, but it will. They were also, he was their kind of head Honcho Lawyer. He's the head of the, they had a cult in Omaha called Exarban, which is Nebraska's Bend Backwards. They had no, you couldn't pick it or anything, you know. We had some times with them in Omaha, too. Those were not calm days, they were hectic.
And so, was there anything else significant during that bakery strike, Jack, that would be useful for me to...
No, the strike started out, we picketed, we maintained the picket line. And we didn't have any effort on the part of any of the three major bakers to attempt to operate during the strike. And it was a wait and see. And we held out, and we put the heat on them, and they settled this with us. And not very, Francis B. Matthews was the lawyer.
Francis B. Matthews?
Yeah.
God, you've got a good memory, Jack.
Huh?
Sure got a good memory.
Well, it ain't so good as it used to be.
Oh, all right.
But he was chief counsel for the Union Pacific Railroad.
Uh-huh.
And he, with David Swore, another attorney, were the kingmakers for the Omaha and that whole Missouri Valley. Sioux City followed Omaha quite a bit. And that's who they were. David Swore, S-W-O-R-R, and Francis B. Matthews. And that was during the days of the Union Pacific premiere, when they had that big movie. And they put Omaha in that kind of element, those kind of clothes and that kind of atmosphere. They had horses tied up, they had false fronts. So it was quite a thing, all right. It was around that time in 38.
Well, in Omaha now, were the bakery drivers organized? Do you remember?
Well, they had been. They beat the bakery strike. Peterson Baking Company was the big baking company in Omaha that broke the strike there in about 35, was off the time they broke the streetcar strike. And we organized them, that is, the Omaha drivers did, and they negotiated an agreement with them at a later time. And we were negotiating with, they were not only with the bakers, but with the dairy companies, too. Robert's Dairy was a big one. But,
Is that Omaha now or Sioux City?
Omaha.
Robert's was, I think, in Sioux City, too.
Well, they may have had plants there. That's quite likely.
I saw one of their ads in a paper that I was reading. I think the Union has carried an ad for Robert's Dairy.
Yeah. Now, you asked me about Wallace Short.
Yeah.
Yes, I had many, many conversations with him. I didn't write any articles for him, but I had lots of talks with him.
You say you didn't write them?
I didn't write them.
I
may have submitted some articles now and then, but they were spur of the moment things. But I had long talks with him. I used to have long talks with him.
Uh-huh.
I didn't.
The articles, some of them sound kind of like the way you talk even today.
Well,
They're listed under the heading of the Executive Committee of Local 383.
Well, then I was responsible for that, if those were the statements.
And they're certainly very interesting.
But I talked to Short many, many times. And he was a good book. He had a good head. And if they were written from the executive board, I probably had a large hand in writing them. But I wouldn't say, yes, I wrote them.
It doesn't make any difference, but I just...
Yeah.
You know, when I,
no,
when I
if,
them,
if
I,
it was written over the head of the executive board, I wrote them.
Yeah, because they're so well written that... Now, for example, in one of the papers, Ralph Johnson wrote what he called like a kind of a history of Local 383.
Uh-huh.
And when I compare that article with that appears under Ralph's signature,
yeah,
these articles that I'm suggesting that you might have written is all different in the world.
Yeah, well, now Ralph was a good head. And Ralph was one of the defendants and one of the victims in the frame-up. And, he and Fouts were involved in that dynamiting, alleged dynamiting, There was nothing to it. There was another frame up. And the case was, we won the case. It was, the case was so raw that the Attorney General of South Dakota, I think his name was Leo Temme, wouldn't write an appeal. He just let it go by default. Now, I can't prove that, and that shouldn't be written. But it's strange that an Attorney General on a labor case at that time would overlook an appeal. I just felt that the best way he thought he could get out of it was blame one of his underlings for not properly being timely on it. I think that's the way it might have went. Because I know capitalist law and capitalist lawyers, and I know smart ones and dumb ones, and he was a pretty shifty dude.
Well, Jack, maybe we've talked long enough tonight. My tape is...
Yeah, okay.
This has been real helpful on this big brief break. I really appreciate
it. Well, that's the best I can do with it on short notice.
Oh, God, it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Could I call you?
Well, now I don't want to get into an exhaustive, complete... I just can't do it.
But this is real helpful, what you're giving me, because it's some of these things that I read in the Unionist and in the, you know, the Sioux City Tribune, I'm able to kind of put the pieces together.
Yeah, well, you see now, when the books that Farrell wrote were written, we tried to do the best we could on it. He and I, and when he'd write a chapter, he'd mail it to me, and we'd go over it. If there was anything that was wrong or out of text or needed some trimming up, I'd either write him or tell him, and then it would be redrafted. I can't get back into now writing a contradiction to that.
And
I'm not going to be a part of it. I'm still burning in the shabby way that the Socialist Workers' Party treated me about a friend and a fellow worker that I had the relationship that I had with Dobbs. When the hierarchy of the Socialist Workers' Party never held a job in their life. There ain't none of them that were workers. They were all some kind of goddamn students. And they're professional students. And they don't understand the loyalty and the affection and the bond of brotherhood that you can have with a man like Dobbs or any of us that went through that period. Literally speaking, our life was on the line. And there were two assassinations to prove it. And when you get shacked up with guys like that, you ain't going to give them up. And if the Socialist Workers' Party wants to change their repudiate Trotsky, they can very, very well do it. But I ain't going to lend them any credence or any aid or anything else, particularly the way they insulted me, sat there in a room and listening to the memorial of Farrell related by a poor girl who was pitiful. It was hideous. And I'm sitting there and had to pay to get in. Jesus Christ, if that didn't send me offshore. Well, what time is convenient for you?
Well, I'm at your disposal.
No, I can't make it every Saturday night.
Okay.
No, that's too much. I have other affairs going. I have a meeting tomorrow that I have to prepare for tonight. Sundays, I'm kind of active Sundays. You know, we're having big problems in our union here. So it'd have to be a couple of weeks down the road at least.
I'll just throw out a date like the 13th of February, Jack.
The 13th of February?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah, I'll try that. Now, the other night, my car broke a front brake shoe and it locked up and I couldn't do anything with it. And when you called me that day, I was just having having it delivered to my yard where we could repair it.
Were you in an accident, Jack?
No. Fortunately, it just locked up and broke.
Oh, you're lucky then.
It had a right front brake shoe.
Huh. What kind of a car is it?
I got a Ford.
I've never had that happen. I've always driven for it.
Well, what happened, I had the brakes repaired in the shop about a year ago, and I don't drive it. I drive a pickup quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
And I had the brakes repaired, and somewhere along the line, one of the back, there was a pin in there that holds it onto the backing plate, crystallized and broke.
Uh-huh.
And when I stepped on the brake, it locked up. And it ruined the drum. I had to get a new drum, and I was busy on it for quite some time. I done the repair. hold your cars, you know. If you have problems, the shops won't work on it account of the liability, so you got to more or less do it yourself.
Well, Jack, I really appreciate this, and I'll call you the 13th.
Yeah, you bear in mind that I'm sensitive about Sioux City.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a very, I had so much bad luck there.
Yeah.
And I spent so much time there. I'm sensitive, and there's other reasons for it. Okay, we'll talk to you later.
Because I'll keep this in mind, too,
yeah.
And the things that I'm doing,
yeah.
Jack.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Jack.